Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 233, Internet Mormons versus Chapel Mormons, a panel featuring Jason Galantine, Scott Denhalter, Michael Ash, and Christine Haglin Harris.
I've been instructed not to start early. So, 11:15, let's go ahead and get started. Welcome everybody. This is session number 233, a panel on Internet Mormons versus Chapel Mormons. I'd like to welcome everybody here to our session this morning. A couple of business items just to get rolling. The first thing I've been asked to do is remind everyone that admission to all sessions is by name tag or ticket only. Tickets can be purchased from the registration table. We like to emphasize that this is very important because in recent years we have had an increase of symposium crashers, otherwise known as social loafers or free riders. Who attend sessions without paying. Not that we don't love you, but we do have to pay the Sheraton for the room and the expense. And unlike the Internet, which we know everything there is free, we do have to pay for our physical facilities. So in addition to asking that you follow that honor system and participate to support our community with your wallets and purses, we would also like to encourage you to support the community by visiting our booksellers and our art sellers here in the hotel as well. And for those of you who don't know, the art sale is not just big, fancy, expensive art. There is jewelry and other affordable sorts of things as well, I've been told. So, at this point, let me ask everybody who owns a cell phone or a pager to hold it up. Show me real quick. Please check that it's silenced. We make that announcement in every session. We have been for a while, and inevitably, a couple of phones will go off. And if you are like me, it's simply because you weren't paying attention when we made the announcement. In fact, last year I was chairing a session where the speaker was at the podium talking. Cell phone went off twice, went off three times. She started to get a little irate. Said, "Well, I'm just going to stop until whoever owns that cell phone turns it off." Went off again. It was in her purse, right down beside the podium. So, please make that note. I am going to do a little bit of setup here, since I am the moderator. But I am going to turn the bulk of the framing over to Jason here in just a minute when we get into the panelists. Jason Galantine is really the inspiration or the spark behind this session, so I will let him sort out all of the interesting nuances in the name for the title, Internet Mormons, Chapel Mormons, a little bit of background and history behind that terminology. My take is a little bit different. I was intrigued by the idea and the topic simply because I come from a generation that has bridged the old to the new. I am both young enough and old enough to remember when word processing came out, and I discovered this right in the middle of graduate school when I was writing papers and all the rest. I mean, this was a technological revolution that for me was life-altering. At the same time, you know, I had an advisor on my dissertation committee who had written his dissertation on punch cards. And whenever his advisors wanted to change, he would simply go back and change his punch cards and then run them through his mainframe. How many of you know what I'm talking about, punch cards? Well, okay, enough of you in here. now, you know, we go back, we make edits and changes and, you know, hit a print button and we get the whole document formatted and whatnot. The internet and technology, people like to say, has changed all of the rules. But at the same time, the more things change, the more they stay the same. If you believe the words of Ecclesiastes, there is nothing new under the sun. I believe he was talking about our generation as well, despite the technologies. For many of us, here at Sunstone conferences, we often talk about the word community, a Sunstone community. Creating, fostering, and maintaining a community is a term that we often use, but creating and fostering a community is actually not an explicit objective of the Sunstone Foundation. Nevertheless, it emerges in many ways spontaneously. Now, a lot of that is happening on the internet. Internet communities are springing up, and you hear people who identify themselves with communities, with groups. But still, a lot of the basics that make a community are still in place. There's some sort of acknowledgement of that community. There's an awareness of its role in their lives. Some of the items that contribute to the give and take of a vibrant and healthy community need to be in place, whether it's an internet community, a chapel community, a Sunstone community, or what have you. There need to be honest expressions, open communication and sharing, open examination and inquiry, authentic service, responsible and respectful interchange of ideas. Notice I'm talking about a vibrant and healthy community here, right? They have to have something in common. Now, for many Latter-day Saints who are embracing new technologies, I suspect this might be what was happening when reading and writing became more prolific. You know, written records have been around for generations, but access to written records has not. Gandhi made an interesting observation at one point in his life when he was building these ashram communities. He made the observation that a written newspaper, magazine, or periodical was central to the development and sustaining of a community. Well, the internet has changed the physical location of that community, but it's a community nonetheless. So people who identify themselves as internet Mormons, in some sense, are a member of that community. Now, I'm going to let Jason expand on that because he's got a little bit of a different take. But that's what these panel presentations are about. We give an opportunity to approach something from a variety of perspectives. The internet and internet technology has exposed, at least technologically literate Latter-day Saints, to ideas, debates on topics, and so on, such as anti-Mormon arguments and claims, often for the very first time. Consequently, LDS apologists have brought their defenses online in order to, in many cases, counteract or minimize the critics' influence. Yet an interesting thing happens, because in the process of neutralizing such attacks, one of the laws of unintended consequences may be perhaps that apologists have inadvertently redefined the role and relevance of the prophets and, by extension, Mormonism itself. So a number of the questions that we have asked all of the panelists to flesh out in greater detail include the following. Does Mormonism, as defined by the apologists and as taken in by faithful web-surfing Mormons, correspond to Mormonism as defined by the average member in the pews? If you use the reading and writing analogy, these are the ones who can't use the new technology, or at least don't avail themselves to it. And so is that difference, that literacy, if you will, creating a divide? And if so, what are the main points where internet Mormons differ from chapel Mormons? How are these differences playing out in LDS chapels, seminaries, and institutes today? How might things change even more as greater numbers of Latter-day Saints become aware of the criticisms and defenses, which often involve shifts in basic understandings or approaches to questions? So with that setup, let me just real quickly run through an introduction of our four panelists, and then we will let them have at it. If we follow the timing, we should have at least 20 to 30 minutes for Q&A at the end, if all goes well. So, as I mentioned, Jason Galantine is the spark of the inspiration behind this session. And so we're going to let him go first and provide some richer context and framing beyond what I've shared. Jason is a graduate of Utah Valley State College. He is webmaster of Dr. Shade's Mormonism page. So those of you who have been there and want to see what Dr. Shade's actually looks like, he is here in the flesh. We're going to switch the order just a little bit. After Jason, we're going to invite Michael Ash to share his thoughts with us. Michael Ash is from Ogden, Utah, webmaster of the Mormon Fortress. He is also one of the apologists that we mentioned in the abstract. He is a contributor to FAIR and also is involved with the management there. And Michael also has published before in Dialogue and the Farms Review. After Michael, we're going to invite Christine Haglund Harris to share her insights with us. Christine, it's kind of interesting. I don't know how many of you have ever been to her blog on the Times and Seasons, but one of the interesting things that I noted there is she has a list of all the places she's lived. Okay? Huntsville, Alabama, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Los Alamos, New Mexico, Marburg, Germany, Nashville, Tennessee, Boston, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Irvine, California, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Pleasanton, California, and now is in Swampscott, Massachusetts. With a trajectory like that, I guess I'm kind of seeing an obvious embracing of the internet as a nice place to put down roots, where no matter where your next move takes you, you're always going to be at that website. She lives in Swampscott with her husband, Stephen, and is the mother of three adorable and highly entertaining children. She has an AB from Harvard in German Studies, an MA from the University of Michigan in German Literature, and she says that she hopes to finish a PhD in something much more practical in the future, like musicology or religion. So Christine gets a little more introduction because she's one of the people who took the time to actually send me her bio, beyond what was in the program. So, last, we're going to hear from Scott Denhalter. Scott is perhaps known more to many of you through his contributions as the Cyber Saints section editor for our magazine here at Sunstone. Scott is lives in Syracuse, Utah right now. He's also a writer, formerly the webmaster of Mormon Village. We're going to let Scott follow up then at the end of our four panelists. So we'll proceed through the group, and then after they're done, we'll take time for some questions and answers. So, Jason.
Thank you. Anyways, I have been an active participant on internet message boards for about 6 years now. My first foray was into the board at RFM, which is an acronym for Recovery from Mormonism. When participants there would comment on LDS doctrine, they would sometimes say things such as, "Does anyone know what the church believes this week?" or "Figuring out what's official LDS doctrine is like trying to nail Jell-O to a tree." Although I was familiar with controversies such as the rise and fall of the Adam God doctrine or the adoption and subsequent abandonment of polygamy, I considered the teachings of the LDS church today to be fairly consistent. It even had a correlation committee to make sure that nothing unauthorized or unofficial found its way into teaching manuals or other products published by the church. So, of course, I found those particular barbs about the church's alleged inconsistency to be rather harsh. Sometime later, I discovered message boards inhabited chiefly by believers in the church. By far, the most interesting among them were those that allowed critics of the church to make comments and otherwise engage in debate. Up until my own discovery of the Mormon community on the internet, it had been my experience that defenses of the church usually took the form of bolstering the case for it by any means necessary. In other words, responses to attacks on the church usually took the form of strengthening and fortifying the church against those attacks. For example, when responding to the criticism that there is no scientific evidence whatsoever for the flood of Noah, it was pointed out that fossils of sea creatures had been found high up in the Himalayas and that science has been wrong many times in the past. Yet once I happened upon LDS-centered debates on the internet, I began seeing brand new defenses of the church, which took me completely by surprise. In addition to the usual, you're just taking it out of context and the he was misquoted defenses, along with, of course, the ever-present slandering of the disbeliever's character, I began seeing counterattacks along the lines of, don't tell us what we believe. We Mormons are the best judges of what we believe. Yet this was usually in response to a quote from a prophet. In other words, I was rather shocked to see defenders of the church saying, don't try to tell us what we believe, when the critic quoted something that Mormons do indeed believe. Hand in hand with the don't tell us what we believe defense was the brand new that's not official doctrine defense and its twin sibling, it was only his opinion defense. For the first time in my life, I began seeing routine, run-of-the-mill LDS beliefs dismissed by the Mormons themselves as being non-doctrinal. Until that point in time, I thought that Mormon doctrine consisted of the teachings heard over the pulpit at General Conference, books printed by the church itself for use in Sunday meetings and seminary and institute classes, and talks given in church, minus, of course, for some of the things that you hear during fast and testimony meetings. I also thought that Bruce R. McConkie's Mormon doctrine was, in fact, Mormon doctrine. In short, I considered it a given that LDS doctrine was whatever the majority of the members believed and continued to believe without correction from church authorities. But then I began hearing that there was a difference between Mormon doctrine and official Mormon doctrine. Generally speaking, defenders of the church claim that official Mormon doctrine is that which is found between the covers of the four standard works and nothing else. Anything else is the prophet's opinion. Inspired though it may be, it is still, strictly speaking, only his opinion. In practice, this meant that any time a critic of the church would raise a sensitive issue, such as God conceiving Jesus through sexual intercourse, or Africans being less valiant in the pre-existence, an apologist could just say, that was never official doctrine, or that was only his opinion, and thereby attempt to get a free pass. This was in stark contrast to the defenses I had been used to seeing before the advent of the internet. Nowadays, instead of strengthening and fortifying the church against attacks, as I mentioned earlier, defenders of the church were making it into a moving target so nothing could stick. The more criticism which were leveled against the church, the more these defenses were employed. After some time of this, it was shocking to see just how few of the members' cherished beliefs were actually doctrinal after all. Likewise, it was surprising to discover how many of the teachings of the modern prophets were, in actuality, merely their own opinions. At that point, it became clear to me why ex-Mormons had sayings such as, what does the church believe this week, or figuring out what's official doctrine is like trying to nail jello to a tree. One day, after years of observing and participating in these goings-on, it began to dawn on me that despite all my activity on the internet, my initial observation had been correct after all. The teachings which passed through the hands of the Correlation Committee were still as internally consistent as I remembered them being. At the same time, I began realizing that the apologists' defenses followed general patterns of their own. Their responses to any given criticism were relatively easy to predict. So here we had one set of relatively consistent beliefs coming from the church itself, and another set of beliefs, albeit somewhat less consistent, coming from the church's defenders. Yet in spite of this general predictability coming from both camps, observers still couldn't get a definitive answer to the question, what do Mormons believe? And that's when it hit me. Like a bolt out of the blue, I made a realization which forever altered my view of LDS apologetics. For all intents and purposes, we're essentially talking about two separate religious paradigms, similar to the way we have the Mormonism which followed Joseph Smith III versus the Mormonism which followed Brigham Young. We now have Mormonism as conceptualized by its prophets versus Mormonism as conceptualized by its apologists. Of course, the next obvious step was to give names to these two different paradigms of LDS thought. Without much hesitation, the names Internet Mormonism and Chapel Mormonism seemed to be the best choices. Needless to say, this is because Internet Mormonism is expounded heavily on the Internet, while Chapel Mormonism is what's taught to us in church. Not long afterward, I wrote and then posted to my website an essay describing this new Internet Mormonism versus Chapel Mormonism phenomenon. Without further ado, here are some of the specific points of divergence between these two schools of LDS thought that I've observed over the years. Number one, whenever science or history conflicts with traditional LDS claims, Chapel Mormons will typically try to bend the facts to fit the prophets, while Internet Mormons are far more comfortable bending the prophets to fit the facts. For example, many Chapel Mormons reject the theory of evolution since former prophets have spoken out against it. Internet Mormons, however, are much more accepting of evolution, believing that the prophets who spoke against it merely didn't understand God's creative process. Number two, when the apologists contradict the prophets, Internet Mormons almost always go with the apologists, while Chapel Mormons almost always go with the prophets. For example, during the Zion's Camp March, Joseph Smith identified some Native American remains as those of Zelph, a white Lamanite who fell in battle during the closing era of the Book of Mormon. Chapel Mormons take this as further evidence for the hemispheric model of Book of Mormon geography. But since this goes against the limited geography theory of the Book of Mormon, Internet Mormons claim that Joseph wasn't actually conveying bona fide revelation. Number three, Internet Mormons believe that the words Lamanite and Native American refer to two entirely separate cultural and linguistic groups. Chapel Mormons believe that Lamanites and Native Americans are one and the same. Internet Mormons believe that Noah's flood was a localized event covering only a certain area. Chapel Mormons usually believe that Noah's flood was a global event covering the entire world. Number five, Internet Mormons believe Lehi and his family landed in a new world filled with Asiatic inhabitants. Chapel Mormons believe Lehi and his family landed in a new world devoid of inhabitants, save perhaps for at least one remaining Jaredite. Number six, when discussing prophetic statements, Internet Mormons often say it was only his opinion. Chapel Mormons almost never say it was only his opinion, believing that a prophet's words and God's words are essentially one and the same. Number seven, Internet Mormons believe that the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, or FARMS, is correct and that the Hill Cumorah was located somewhere in Mesoamerica. Chapel Mormons believe that Joseph Smith was correct and that the Hill Cumorah was located in western New York and was the same hill from which he retrieved golden plates. Number eight, Internet Mormons tend to want to filter a prophet's words through both his likely cultural influences and his limited sphere of knowledge. Chapel Mormons tend to take a prophet's words at face value. For example, Chapel Mormons believe that in the Book of Mormon, the word horse really means horse. Internet Mormons believe that Joseph filtered the concept of an animal used for riding through his 19th century culture, thus saying horse when he really meant deer. Number nine, Internet Mormons believe that a prophet's words may not apply to at least some of the people he's addressing. Chapel Mormons tend to believe that a prophet's words apply to everyone he's addressing. For example, when President Benson gave his "A Woman's Place is in the Home" talk, Chapel Mormons interpreted that as meaning no married women should work outside the home. Internet Mormons, on the other hand, interpreted that as meaning no married women should work outside the home except those families who can't afford the loss of income. Now, of course, at about the same time I posted this essay to my website, I shared my Internet Mormon Chapel Mormon epiphany with others on the Internet. I thought that this new model would be a great tool whereby Mormons and Quidditch could better understand each other. Needless to say, the reaction was mixed. With some exceptions, of course, the great majority of doubting Mormons and ex-Mormons outright accepted or at least heartily welcomed this new model. I received emails telling me that my observations were right on. I was also told on other occasions that what I described was exactly what they were experiencing but couldn't quite put into words. Interestingly enough, this model was also accepted by a surprising number of Chapel Mormons, some of whom had no problem referring to themselves as such. However, this idea was, and still is, bitterly opposed by the Internet Mormons. This probably isn't very surprising, since defenders of the faith, having shed a great deal of blood, sweat, and tears to ward off the attacks of the critics, probably resent the implication that their pet theories are way outside the mainstream or otherwise not in harmony with their own prophets. As such, they have raised a number of challenges to the Internet Mormon, Chapel Mormon model. Now, here are those objections and the corresponding rebuttals. Number one, Internet Mormons attend church in the chapels every Sunday and fulfill just as many callings as Chapel Mormons. Likewise, Chapel Mormons often own computers, surf the web, and check email. The response to this objection is that the terms Internet Mormonism and Chapel Mormonism don't indicate the only things their adherents do. The terms merely paid tribute to the places at which these respective brands of belief are most likely to be encountered. For example, if you want to find a dedicated Mormon who nonetheless believes that the Lamanites were not the principal ancestors of the American Indians, you'll find one much quicker by looking on the Internet than you will by looking in a chapel. Objection number two, it's unfair to describe two Mormonisms. Chapel Mormons are merely the ones who don't study their religion. Of course, some members will be more intellectually oriented than others. If the members would just study their history and read more FARMS material, they'd all be Internet Mormons. The response to this objection, of course, is that if their teachings are any indication, the prophets themselves are all Chapel Mormons, and I can't emphasize that enough. In other words, the so-called uneducated Mormons believe what they do because they take the words of the prophets seriously, regardless of science. I've seen some members actively reject what apologists say, saying that such people are relying on the arm of flesh and the wisdom of the world instead of the oracles of God. And let's face it, how many of us can name a single conference address from 1830 until now in which the prophet opened with the phrase, This is only my opinion, but. Number three, or objection number three, there is a wide umbrella of beliefs in any religious tradition. Therefore, it's folly to think that individual beliefs won't vary from Mormon to Mormon. The response to this objection is that the modern general authorities take great pains to ensure that their words are in harmony with each other. The Correlation Committee also does its best to make sure that the same lessons are taught church-wide. Sticking to the manual is encouraged. Besides, if a wide umbrella of beliefs is what the brethren really encouraged, then perhaps someone ought to inform the September 6. Objection number four. There are far more similarities between Internet Mormons and Chapel Mormons than there are differences. Whether or not Noah's flood covered the entire earth is an extremely trivial issue, whereas Mormons all agree on central issues such as the restoration of the priesthood and the divinity of Christ. The response to this objection is that there are also far more similarities than differences between the Salt Lake City-based Mormon Church and the Colorado City-based Mormon Church. Both churches believe in the divine mission of Joseph Smith, both churches accept the Book of Mormon as scripture, and the list goes on and on. Yet it's precisely the differences between the two groups which cause us to consider them as entirely different churches. Put another way, there are far more similarities between wolves and chihuahuas than there are differences, but few people would argue against listing them as separate species. Objection number five, Internet Mormon beliefs, such as the limited geography theory of the Book of Mormon, have been around much, much longer than the Internet itself has. Therefore, the term Internet Mormon is inadequate. The response to this objection is that such people had no place to freely air their beliefs before now. The Internet has become a haven for the adherents of these apologetic theories to gather. Once again, the terms Internet Mormonism and Chapel Mormonism pay tribute to the places one is most likely to encounter these brands of Mormon thought, not the places where these paradigms were created, per se. Objection number six. The terms Internet Mormon and Chapel Mormon are too limiting. Mormons, just like anyone else, cannot be pigeonholed into only two categories. Many other terms need to be invented in order to fully capture the LDS experience. The response to this objection is that all other terms that I have ever seen used to describe the various brands, so to speak, of Mormons, such as Jack Mormons, Iron Rod Mormons, Sunstone Mormons, etc., all have to do with either level of commitment to or degree of belief in the church. Internet Mormons and Chapel Mormons, on the other hand, are all very committed, very strongly believing members of the church. These two terms simply indicate the two separate paradigms through which the teachings of the prophets are being interpreted. And last one, objection number seven, the terms Internet Mormons and Chapel Mormons are, for whatever reason, just not good enough. Better terms should be used. And the response to this objection is that I have yet to see anyone come up with better terms. One website described the two camps as elite religion versus common religion. I've also heard type 1 Mormons versus type 2 Mormons. If we wanted to, I suppose we could call them prophet Mormons and apologist Mormons, or perhaps follow the prophet Mormons and it was only his opinion Mormons. Yet none of these other terms are anywhere near as intrinsically descriptive of the beliefs thereof. One online participant stated that he knew immediately the exact set of beliefs I was talking about as soon as he read the words Internet Mormonism. And with such an endorsement such as that, along with the fact that these seem to be the two terms which are catching on anyway, I believe the words Internet Mormonism and Chapel Mormonism remain the best and most descriptive ones. Now in closing, I imagine that all this may seem to some to be a tempest in a teacup. Perhaps some are wondering why this is an issue at all. The reason I believe that the recognition of these two paradigms of LDS thought is important is because we're seeing, for the first time in the history of the church, an emergence of a school of thought wherein one need not take prophetic teachings as seriously as the prophets themselves exhort, yet remain a completely dedicated member regardless. For the first time, a Mormon can reasonably believe that he or she knows more about Mormonism than do the brethren themselves, and yet remain in full fellowship. For the first time, there is a real possibility that some members will greet prophetic pronouncements with skepticism, yet consider themselves good Mormons in every sense of the word. In short, the recent controversy over Lamanite DNA and how the apologists are reinterpreting basic LDS beliefs is just one aspect of the Internet Mormon-Chapel Mormon dichotomy. I believe that the degree to which Internet Mormonism expands within the church just might be the degree to which the prophets lose their relevance in the daily lives of the members. And that, I believe, is the reason why this issue is so noteworthy. Thanks very much.
I see four main issues raised explicitly or implicitly by Jason's paper. Number one, the Internet has been the vehicle for spreading less traditional ideas about some Mormon issues. I would agree. This would be an interesting area of research. How are traditional views of certain LDS issues being affected by the spread of information on the web? Unfortunately, I don't think that Jason's study addresses this question. Certainly more LDS information, good, bad, bizarre, conservative, liberal, traditional, and non-traditional, is more readily available now to the general membership than at any other time in past history. This has opened the doors for more LDS to study, investigate, and discuss things that are not generally discussed in church. Jason believes that there is a dichotomy between what is taught in church versus what is espoused on the internet, hence the terms chapel and internet Mormons. For the moment, I'll bypass the supposed dichotomy and focus on the terminology. While acknowledging that supposed peculiarities to internet Mormons predate the internet, Jason argues that the term internet Mormon is partially a tribute to the internet as a catalyst for the explosion of this new brand of Mormonism, as well as the location for discussing these peculiarities. If the terms were used strictly as designators for the location of these types of discussions, I would agree with this terminology. Book of Mormon translation, geography, Book of Abraham, evolution, are all things discussed on the internet and not generally in church. But as the terms are used by Jason, I find his terminology ambiguous and useless in distinguishing different LDS paradigms. Access to the internet, frequency of surfing the internet, or familiarity with the internet, as well as frequency attending church, plays no part in Jason's terminology. He has offered, as he has here just a few minutes ago, to consider better definitions. Some have suggested apologist, non-apologist. You heard some of his other suggestions. I won't go through those again. But he prefers, of course, the internet versus chapel Mormons. I believe that Jason's purpose for suggesting a binary division among believers appears not to be so much as to understand common characteristics among believers with differing paradigms, but has rather been fabricated as a rhetorical weapon intended to claim a dichotomy between LDS scholars, apologists, internet Mormons, and LDS prophets, chapel Mormons. It seems fashionable among many LDS critics to try to brush aside LDS scholarly arguments by claiming that they are not in step with the words of the prophets, who ironically are rejected as true prophets by these very critics. Jason tries to pit apologists, internet Mormons, against the prophets. By claiming a dichotomy, Jason can try to brush aside LDS scholarly arguments as not being in tune with the prophets. Galantine, right?
Yeah.
He's tipped his hand here as well as on the internet on more than one occasion. For example, in May of this year, on both the Times and Seasons message board and the Fair message board, Jason claimed that according to the scriptures and the prophets, God is a chapel Mormon. He also proclaimed God is not a member of the elite religion, same term as his internet Mormon. He also wrote, if the scriptures and prophets are any indication of the mind of God, then God believes that Noah's flood covered the earth. God believes the Lamanites were indeed the principal ancestors of the American Indians. God believes the Hill Cumorah was the New York. The problem is that he attempts to force us to accept his definitions of a prophet, the words of a prophet, and the mind of God. Fortunately, LDS are not bound to accept or defend his interpretations. Jason's agenda in formulating this dichotomy seems transparent. Real Mormons must reject the arguments of LDS scholars and apologists whose views are contrary to revealed doctrine. This appears as an interesting way of poisoning the well of LDS scholarship. Third topic, internet Mormons have radically different views on many LDS issues than chapel Mormons. This gets a little more to the heart of Jason's reasoning for claiming a dichotomy. Any validity to Jason's argument on this issue, however, becomes obscured by his terminology and methodology. If I were to restate his argument in a way I'd find convincing, I might express it thusly. Many LDS scholars understand certain issues differently than has been traditionally understood among most LDS. I would agree with that. In virtually every discipline or issue where there are unknowns, there will be varying opinions. Are there different views among some LDS on non-essential issues? Most certainly. Many of the different opinions often hinge on the person's familiarity with the issue, what questions they've asked, as well as their level of understanding of the arguments that have already been presented. Some LDS are better informed or educated on certain LDS issues than other members. That does not mean, of course, that all educated members accept the same arguments. Because the terms educated and informed imply ignorant and uninformed, these terms appear pejorative to some, and we would want better terminology. Should Jason wish to adopt this modified understanding of the differing opinions of LDS varying issues, I would suggest borrowing some words from the French. We could have Mormonologists au Coran, or those whose study of Mormon issues are current and up-to-date, as well as insouciant Mormonologists, or those who are happily unconcerned with the debated issues. And once again, I must point out there is a wide range of overlapping and at times contrary belief on many LDS issues from members in both camps. J- Jason chides Internet Mormons for supposedly claiming that many of those who've left the church have done so because they have not fully understood their religion, whereas Chapel Mormons supposedly tell Internet Mormons that the apologetic beliefs are radically different from what they learned in church. Once again, this is an oversimplification. In a nation of non-readers, it's hardly a surprise that many Mormons are unfamiliar with LDS scholarly issues. I suspect that many Catholics are unfamiliar with scholarly Catholic issues, and most Americans are relatively unfamiliar with scholarly Christian issues. The object of church is to commune with Christ, to learn the gospel principles, and to become spiritually edified. Church is generally not the setting designated for debating the coverage or depth of Noah's flood, Book of Mormon geography, and the translation process of the Golden Plates. Astute LDS will find, however, that many of the apologetic and scholarly issues have been noted or discussed in the inside or less prominent, although officially linked, church-related publications such as BYU studies or even the history of the church. It is hardly the fault of the church when members fail to notice these studies that are non-essential and not a primary part of the church's Sunday curriculum. In what areas do Internet and Chapel Mormons differ? Are these issues peripheral or pertinent to the gospel? Do these differences suggest differing religions? According to Jason's website, he listed, I don't know if I lost track, but I think it was 10 that I found initially on his website, differences. And because he's covered these, I'm going to try to touch briefly on some of these. Nearly half of his four of his examples deal with prophetic fallibility and attempt to argue that Chapel Mormons accept the prophets over facts, scholars, and science. Jason claims that Chapel Mormons will typically try to bend the facts. He's already quoted this, so again, I won't. In fact, on his tagline, on his message board, he frequently quotes John Charles Duffy from his recent Sunstone article, which I have mixed feelings on because he thinks I'm a meanie. But his quote is, "Orthodox intellectuals are willing to judge the truth of traditional claims by how well those claims coincide with the conclusions yielded by scholarship. Saints of a more dogmatic stripe insist on judging the truth of the scholarship by how well it coincides with traditional faith claims." Now, it's important to understand that Duffy compares those LDS with a more dogmatic stripe to Christian fundamentalists. While there certainly are LDS who may be similar to Christian fundamentalists in their approach to the scriptures and fallibility, this would account at best for only some Chapel Mormons. To apply this argument in binary fashion, as if to divide the saints, is once again oversimplistic. What, for example, are traditional faith claims? The resurrection, as well as the miracles of the Bible, are not only not supported by science and scholarship, but are contrary to science and scholarship. Yet we find that Orthodox intellectuals, Internet Mormons, are just as willing as Chapel Mormons to accept the doctrinal teachings of the prophets over science and scholarship. In fact, nearly all core LDS beliefs cannot be proven by science, although there might be some evidential support, and they must be accepted primarily on faith that could certainly be described as judging the truth of scholarship by how well it coincides with traditional faith claims. Non-essential faith claims, however, are open to various interpretations. Something Jason doesn't want to allow LDS members or prophets without an accusation of heresy. Jason claims that Chapel Mormons don't believe that a prophet can state his own opinion, an opinion which might be influenced by his culture. He argues that the opposite is believed among Internet Mormons. Interestingly, he claims the prophets themselves have never defined their role the way the apologists have. That's a quote, referring to the fact that apologists have denied prophetic infallibility and have claimed that prophets, both modern and ancient, have had incorrect opinions and beliefs. When apologists argue that prophets do indeed have their own fallible opinion, Jason counters that such apologetic is simply a ploy currently put into overdrive by LDS apologists to brush away any controversial teachings of past prophets. And he asked if a prophet has recently mentioned his opinion in conference. I believe it was not too many conferences ago when President Hinckley said just that. He was talking about, I believe, the after effects of the 9/11 thing and how that we don't necessarily need to worry that it's the end of the world. It's his opinion, so it has been mentioned in conference. Does Jason seriously mean to suggest the LDS prophets claim infallibility? To quote Joseph Fielding Smith, and I have several other quotes which I probably don't have time to get to, but Joseph Fielding Smith, "There are times when the leading brethren have expressed their own opinions on various subjects. They have the perfect right to do." And like I said, I have them, Harold B. Lee, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, others, the same thing. So this is not a unique thing that the prophets are claiming, that not everything they say is revelation, that it includes their opinion. Is Jason seriously suggesting that Joseph Fielding Smith is a closet Internet Mormon? Now, three of Galantine's 10 examples deal with his misunderstanding of LDS scholarly issues and arguments for the Book of Mormon and the nature of the prophets. He argues that while Chapel Mormons use the term Lamanite and Native American interchangeably, Internet Mormons believe they are two entirely separate cultures and linguistic groups. Jason is oblivious to the LDS arguments that discuss this topic and how Internet Mormons can actually use the term interchangeably with comfort, that Lamanites can be both the modern Native Americans as well as a select group. And this we don't have anywhere near the time to get it to, but it boils down to basically genetics, genealogy, and culture. And there's differences. And the terms can be used in all different areas. According to Jason, Internet Mormons believe that the Lehites arrived to a populated America and merged with others, whereas Chapel Mormons believe that the Lehites arrived to an uninhabited America. In a similar vein, he pits the two fictitious groups of Mormons against each other in the identity of the location of the Hill Cumorah. While it's true that most past Mormons and probably most current Mormons may believe in a new world that was inhabited strictly by Lehites, not all LDS apologists or Internet Mormons believe in limited geography. The issue has never been a matter of doctrine, nor settled by revelation. Jason thinks that beliefs of Internet Mormons are diametrically opposed to traditional Mormons because they disagree with more than a century of statements by LDS leaders that the Lehites were responsible for populating the Americas. Is Christianity diametrically opposed to the Bible, to Bible believers, because ancient prophets believed in a flat earth with pillars that were perched upon the heavens, both of which were rejected by modern Christians? Prophets are not raised in cultural vacuums. LDS recognize the prophets, just like all LDS, receive their information line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little and there a little. They are subject to preconceived ideas and culturally programmed dogmas. As Duane Jeffrey commented, if you attended his talk on Noah, he says that when God makes man a prophet, he doesn't unmake him a man. Elder James Talmadge commented on the possibility that Hebrew prophets, Elder James Talmadge of the Council of the Twelve, that Hebrew prophets wrote of events not have been conversant with only a small fraction of the surface of the earth, thinking and writing in terms of their own limited geography. I think he's referring to the flood in that particular instance. And more often than not, new information comes only when ideas are challenged and revelation is sought. Early LDS brought many of their Protestant beliefs with them until new revelation was given, and such revelation generally followed a petition for clarification because of some challenge. Kevin Christensen had a good article called Wagging the Dog in Sunstone just recently, where it talks about non-hierarchical revelation, and that was brought up again in Jan Schip's thing, that many times it comes from the bottom on up. So this is not anything unusual to Mormonism. To summarize Jason's example of the differences between these imaginary groups, he suggests that Internet Mormons are radically different than Chapel Mormons because they don't believe in fallible prophets, but neither do Chapel Mormons. They believe that while inspired truths can be spoken by prophets, that all members should seriously contemplate their counsel. Official doctrine is found in standard works, same as Chapel Mormons. These dichotomous camps apparently disagree on the coverage of the flood, although they both accept Noah and that there was a flood. They disagree on the exact location of the Hill Cumorah, although they both agree that there was a Hill Cumorah. And they disagree on the exact genetic link between Native Americans and Lamanites, yet they both agree not only that the Lamanites actually existed, but that the Native Americans can be termed Lamanites. What an odd dichotomy when there is so much agreement. Fourth issue. Finally, Jason didn't talk about his survey that he did recently. He did, I believe it was 38 people he went to doors and 4 internet.
Who's the one that made the
survey? Okay, spent a couple hours on some Sundays going out and asking people a number of questions to determine if they were chapel or internet Mormons. Had a handful of responses. The questions, which he didn't get to and we don't have time to cover, I felt were false dilemmas, vague wording, and designed to elicit his predetermined results. Many of the wording problems were pointed out to him on the message boards before he passed it out, and several people that took the survey had kind of the same comments, that they didn't think it was maybe precise enough. I contacted Dr. Tim Heaton, who's an expert on social statistics, with Jason's questions and results, the survey, and he told me that the sampling and methodology are not well designed. These are not random samples, the samples are too small, and the methods are not clearly described. On ZLMB, Jason concludes that while his 4 Internet Mormons, the 4 that were polled, had slightly different views when responding to a few questions, they still fell on the Chapel Mormon side. Thus, there is no evidence to suggest Jason's original thesis that Internet Mormons and Chapel Mormons are diametrically opposed religions. I suggest we jettison any further reference to these ambiguous...
I hang out in a different corner of the internet, which is sometimes called the blogger knuckle. It's a little more genial, I think. I write occasionally for a weblog called Times and Seasons, and there are 10, 11 of us who write there with, I think, wide-ranging opinions on a number of topics. And so just there in that small sample, at least we 10 Internet Mormons have violently different degrees of belief about infallibility of prophets or any one of your 10 points of disagreement. So the other thing that I think makes me spectacularly unsuited to participate in this back and forth is that I grew up with very comfortable with the idea that Mormonism embraces truth wherever it's found, and that it was my job to find it and reconcile it and make it work. My father, who's a physics professor, experimentalist, said, try it out, taste it, see what's good. He spent many of his Saturdays in college in the Yale library reading anti-Mormon literature just to make sure that he had thought about the things he should think about in his Mormonism. And so that was really comfortable for me. I went through about 5 Mary Miss teachers with my crisis over polygamy. And I did the Mountain Meadows Massacre as a targeteer. I think there are a finite number of issues, and they're the same issues that some Mormons will confront at some point in their study of their religion. Evolution might be one, which is related to hermeneutics, how to read the Old Testament. You know, you can start right there with Genesis and work through that. Polygamy and other difficult episodes in Mormon history, many people bump into at some point and have to figure out a way to deal with. The historicity of the Book of Mormon, again, related to how to read Scripture, and finally how to interpret prophetic, the statements of modern prophets. I think the internet gives people a lot of different tools and some new access, easier access to ways of grappling with these questions, but I don't think they're new questions, and I think they're unlikely to create schisms in the church. Mormonism has always been a big tent doctrinally. There are well-documented differences, theological differences among members of the 12, from one prophet to the next. It's never been hard to find those. Mark Leone, in his, I think, 1968 or 69 book, The Roots of Modern Mormonism, said that Mormonism was essentially atheological. And you can disagree with that, but it's not a new insight to say that Mormon belief is all over the map. I think Mormonism has always valued orthopraxis over orthodoxy. That is, when you go for your temple recommended interview, you'll be asked what you do a lot more than what you believe. The questions about belief are few and not detailed. I've never been asked about what I think about Noah's flood, and I don't think anyone cares what I think about the flood. I have learned to keep some of my opinions to myself in gospel doctrine class, mostly because I think that the nature of the church as a missionary church means that there are people at all different levels in your average church meeting, and I generally don't think it's my job to help people bump into the major dilemmas that I listed that Mormons might bump into. So what does the internet change about the Mormon church in the early 2000s? I think the sort of the second half of the 20th century was all about correlation and how the church would, as it grew, keep a hold of its doctrine and its practice and ensure that there was some core of belief that could be counted on. And I think that the next few decades may be about how correlation falls apart and is played with around the edges, how Mormons deal with this hugely expanding church and the different backgrounds of belief that people come in with. And I think the internet may play an important role there. It's interesting in the comments on Times and Seasons, we've had occasional visitors from Europe or other parts of the world, and many of the things that Orthodox, what's Robert Kirby saying, white Orthodox Republican Mormons, take as crucial tenets of Mormondom, which would be to support the president when he goes to war, or to be virulently opposed to same-sex marriage, are not held to be so crucial in Europe, for instance. And I think that the internet will at least let Mormons talk to each other about those kinds of things around the edges. I think the internet makes it easier to access some information. It makes it harder to evaluate information as reliable or not. There's not much way for me to know, for instance, if I visit Dr. Shade's Mormonism page, what his credentials are about Mormonism. And so if I bumped into that, I can imagine people running into information that they don't know quite how to correlate. And I think, people who only buy their religion books at Deseret Book will be uncomfortable with things they find on the internet. But I suspect that the fact that things are difficult to evaluate also makes them easy to dismiss. It's pretty easy to say, oh, well, it was just some guy on the web. Farms, I think, inhabits a different space. It's quasi-official, but CES has always also inhabited a space as sort of quasi-official arbiter of doctrine, but not quite official. So, again, I think the internet makes access easier. It may help people, people may bump into those issues that I named, history, the degree of fallibility of leaders, Book of Mormon historicity, and scriptural interpretation more generally. People may run into those issues sooner or in different forms than they would have before the internet. But I don't see them running into fundamentally different questions because of the internet or because of apologetics. The other thing that I think the internet changes is that it does change the sense of community. For me, having grown up in the house that I did and with the very comfortable attitudes towards ambiguity and towards saying we don't know and we're not sure if Joseph Fielding Smith was right about that, or the Bible tells us who made the world and why, but not how. And so I grew up very comfortable with those things and discovered, sometimes in painful ways in Mormon congregations, that not everyone was as comfortable with those sorts of ambiguities as I was. And the internet makes it easy for me to talk to people who are willing to entertain my notions of Mormonism as being somehow Mormon. And so it means that instead of one person in my ward that I might be able to talk to surreptitiously in the hall, I have a few dozen that I can talk to on the internet, and I like that. But it's not a big change, and so I guess that's my basic thesis, is that the internet may open up or make visible some of these differences in Mormonism, but doesn't fundamentally change them or introduce new questions.
I find it problematic to be asked to discuss how the internet will affect Mormonism, specifically Mormon theology, because I don't know. I can only address it from my own personal experience, from my own perspective. In the mid-70s, I ran into a stranger in the downtown Deseret Book and had a very interesting conversation with him. We discovered that we were both interested in similar titles on the remainder table, and we discussed various ideas and various historical ideas, as well as giving recommendations or critiques of books that we had read. I remember walking home and reflecting on how much I enjoyed that conversation with this complete stranger. Then it began to dawn on me how there was no one like this person in my ward with whom I could speak, nor in my family, nor at work. By the time I reached my apartment, the euphoria had been completely replaced with depression. I opened up one of the volumes of B.H. Roberts' Comprehensive History and began gutting a box of Ho-Hos and a six-pack of Coke. Now, 25 years later, I get to talk with people like this man on a daily basis, and I get to have ideas that I cherish challenged. I get to have them reaffirmed through agreement. I get to have new ideas that I haven't even thought of introduced to me. And I'm able to do this by means of the internet, specifically through email lists. I'm not a big website surfer, and so I'm not really part of this. For example, the anti-Mormon pro-Mormon debates that I do know take place. I've just not really been interested in them, and so I don't. I can't really speak with any authority on how they influence the rest of mainstream Mormonism. I do know how these apologetic debates influence me, and that is very little. And I think that brings to bear an important point, which may help to clarify this dichotomy that we're looking at today, this kind of binary segmentation that stands between Internet Mormons and Chapel Mormons. I don't think that Mormons who use the Internet are in any way an homogenous group, and I think to divide them into two groups is, at best, artificial. As Christ said, "In my Father's house there are many mansions." If you are if you are a Mormon who has access to the internet and uses the internet with any degree of regularity, you discover that there are many, many mansions within the internet. We tend to find the people who share our interests, and then we gravitate toward those people. Sometimes the communities formed by these collections of people are cordial. Sometimes they're not cordial. I think that the temperament of those who gravitate toward the more non-cordial communities are gratified by that kind of give and take. And then there are others who expect a greater degree of civility. I find my experience on the internet to be specifically geared toward Mormon history as well as theological questions which are not discussed differently in my gospel doctrine class or in my high priest group. They're not discussed at all. So we're not talking about what my experience has not been to hear one thing said about the Noachian deluge among high priests, and then to read it something else entirely differently on the internet. We don't talk about the Noachian deluge. We don't talk about polygamy. We don't talk about a great number of issues which have theological impact. I don't think that discussions of doctrine represent the majority of the content that is used in the LDS classroom, nor do I think that discussions of doctrine represent the majority of the content on the internet among Mormon-related sites and Mormon-related groups. In my group, it's kind of like attending a Know Your Religion class where there's 150 to 200 members. There is no program of teachers. There's just simply people standing up and asking questions or making statements. And the walls of the room are lined with thousands of books, and someone can dispute what you're saying, and any request for a citation, the guy just walks to the shelf, pulls off a book, and reads it to the rest of the class. I find this kind of experience to be an enhancement of my experience, my Sabbath day experience, and an adjunct experience, not to be in any way in conflict with that Sabbath experience, and not necessarily to be reinforcing of that Sabbath day experience. I find that most of what is discussed within the LDS classroom is a matter of ethics, orthopraxis, if you will, as opposed to orthodoxy. It's not so much what we believe is discussed, but how do you handle this a given situation? How do we raise our children better? How do we teach them the basic principles of the gospel? How do we protect our children from the dangers of the real world? How do we somehow find a way of convincing ourselves that it really is important for us to go home teaching or visiting teaching? These are practical matters that are discussed on the Sabbath, and I don't see them in conflict with what I enjoy discussing in the mailing lists that I participate in. I do believe that the internet has been impactful among Mormons, but I'm not sure how. And I think that maybe as time progresses, that will be played out more and more. I find my experience has been other than Christine's, and my experience in terms of reliability has been other than Christine's, because again, people's feet are held to the fire in the mailing lists in which I participate. If you say something, you better be prepared to back it up and to have references and citations. You're not always called upon to do so, but people are not careless in what they say, unless they're just not careless. I don't find that lack of concern for precision at all in the mailing lists in which I participate. I have found that lack of precision in a great number of mailing lists, and I don't remain a subscriber for very long. There are groups. There are many, many, many more subsets of Mormon interests out there than I am interested in, and therefore care to participate in. I've discovered as Cyber Saints editor, it's kind of my job to go out there and find some of the more surprising communities, Mormon-related communities that are out there, and there are some that are very surprising. I would have never thought that there was a group that discussed a group of Mormons that discussed skinny dipping, and I was surprised to discover that there are a group of there's a group out there of Mormon men who enjoy being spanked, I thought my particular mailing list on Mormon history was racy. All in all, I think that to dichotomize as complex an environment as the internet is not just artificial, but I don't feel it's instructive in any way. I don't think that it gives us any additional insight. The ideas that are discussed on the internet are not so much disagreed with in my Sabbath experiences as they are just not discussed. So I guess I would simply close by saying that I don't see any, the phrase storm in a teapot was mentioned by Jason, and I think maybe this is a storm in a teapot. I don't think that 5-10 years from now this is going to be something that we're really going to pay much, I mean, we'll give much credence to and say, oh yeah, you know, see, we should have seen this coming. I don't think we're really going to complete, I don't think we can see what's coming, but I don't think this dichotomy is going to be at all impactful to us as Mormons in mainstream or otherwise. Thank you.
Okay, let me go ahead and wrap up this portion, maybe with one observation, then we'll open it up to Q&A from the audience and the panel. I especially thought it was interesting, Scott, you mentioned right at the end that the internet is fascinating, because unlike your geographical ward, where you're not allowed to wander from one congregation and send your membership record to another, on the internet, we're free to come and go. Yeah, you join a list group or visit a site, and if you share, make contributions, and if you get treated with respect and goodwill, and you feel like there's value and benefit, you stay. If not, you move on. One of the paradoxical challenges in a forming community like Sunstone is that we do two things. We provide an open forum, but one of our operating principles is that we need to trust each other to use that open forum in a way that demonstrates respect and goodwill. Now, I'm a professor of organizational behavior, and one of my areas of interest is conflict and conflict management. One of the things that I think is hard for lots of people to do is recognize when conflict is healthy. I don't know how many of you had a chance to hear Janice Allred's session yesterday when she spoke about good guys and bad guys. If you haven't, go out and buy a tape at the end of this session and listen to it, because she did a wonderful job of describing the difference between contention and disagreement. Conflict that's healthy is conflict that's constructive. It's not always comfortable, but it's constructive. So with that in mind, my observation was that our panelists today did a very healthy job of modeling for us the ability to disagree without being disagreeable. So I would like to thank them again for that. All right, so this session is going to be on tape. I am going to ask you if you wouldn't mind coming up and answering your questions into the microphone. We'll get your questions on tape that way. We won't have to worry about summarizing. And then we'll just open it up for the panelists to respond. Come on up.
I guess this question is more maybe directed at you, since you're the one who put together the internet versus chapel. Do you think maybe it's more of a those who pay attention to potential problems versus those who don't? For example, take Christianity. I'd say most people I've talked to haven't even attempted to reconcile, say, all the, you know, Deuteronomy and Leviticus saying all these things like circumcision are going to be forever lasting covenants, whereas Paul and the book of Acts says they're not. Most people don't even try. Others that pay attention do use these games of trying to reconcile that. I would say most, say the regular churchgoers don't even attempt to reconcile evolution with the book of Genesis. They just assume all biologists, anthropologists, geologists, and paleontologists are all somehow wrong, whereas others, they do attempt to somehow play these games with the book of Genesis, try to make it reconcile, or others turn to pseudosciences like creationism. So basically, do you think it's just those who pay attention to the problems versus those who don't? Well, I'd say most don't pay attention.
That's an excellent question. Of course, this whole Internet Mormon, Chapel Mormon dichotomy, so to speak, if there was nobody paying attention to problems and so forth, well, you wouldn't be having apologists rise up and start responding to attacks from the critics and the antis, so to speak. But so normally what you're saying, it wouldn't normally be a problem. Normally it wouldn't even be worth mentioning if it was merely a distinction between the educated portion of Mormons versus the uneducated portion of Mormons, because as I said before, for all intents and purposes, this might sound outrageous, but the prophets themselves are Chapel Mormons. The prophets themselves are, so to speak, uneducated, because the prophets themselves seem to believe that Noah's flood covered the entire earth. They've said in the past that Noah's flood was a baptism by immersion for the temporal salvation of the earth. Once Boyd K. Packer said that evolution completely obviates the need for Christ and repentance, because if there was never any fall, if there was never any fall of Adam and the introduction of death, then what's the plan of salvation all about? What's the mission of Christ all about? So, heck, what else have the prophets said? They always have used the words Lamanites and Native American interchangeably and so forth. So if it was only a distinction between less and more educated, then how come the prophets are Chapel Mormons? How come the prophets are not leading the charge to make everybody else brought, or to bring everybody else into the more educated camp? That's why it's an issue.
Any responses?
I'll respond. I'll respond with something. I don't know if it's what you would have said, and you should certainly have a chance, Michael. I'm sorry. To all intents and purposes, I'm a Chapel Mormon on Sunday. Okay. Okay, and I think that when I'm sitting teaching gospel doctrine, I have a responsibility to not blow people away. And I think that the prophets, I mean, the number of current sitting prophets whom you would get to say that, or, you know, apostles, people we sustain as prophets, seers, and revelators, who you get to say that that the flood was a baptism of the earth, I'll bet it's less than 50%. I'll bet that, you know, several of them would not say anything like that. Anyway, the point is that there are many of us who use different modes of discourse in different situations, and that it doesn't, you know, I don't say things I don't believe on Sunday, okay, but I leave a lot of stuff that I do believe out. Michael's got a more complex answer to this than I do, and I should make my other point later. Mike, you want to say something?
Well, it's also interesting to note that, you know, prophets do sometimes hedge. Not only President Hinckley, but Alma, in answering his son, says, "I give it as my opinion that these issues about the resurrection."
Joseph Smith said, some revelations are from God, some are from Satan, and some are from man."
I think it gets also back to you know, Jason says the prophets are Chapel Mormons. I mean, you know, that's his interpretation of prophets, which I'm not bound by, and I don't have to defend. He uses an example, Boyd K. Packer's, you know, statement on issue of flood. Well, James Talmadge, and I don't have the quote with me, but the same quote that I had earlier, he talks about that he would not have a problem if evolution was correct. So you have prophets, as he's defining it, at odds with each other. If we define prophets as the end sign, then the prophets believe in a limited geography, because they published a two-part series from John Sorensen on that exact issue. So how is, you know, defining the prophets? I mean, obviously this is overseen by the church. A quote here that I didn't have time to read from the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, which I would think as close as anything speaks the minds of the prophets, if that's how you're trying to define it. Gerald Bradford and Larry Dowell write, "There are many subjects about which the scriptures are not clear, and about which the church has made no official pronouncements. In such matters, one can find differences of opinion among church members and leaders. Until the truth of these matters is made known to revelation, there is room for different levels of understanding and interpretation of unsettled issues." It's just ridiculous to claim that God is a chapel Mormon when based on some statements by some of the general authorities when there are differing opinions.
So the thing I actually came up to say was, I make the story really short. I know people who claim to have left the church because of stuff they've seen on the internet. Okay, there's anti-Mormon stuff that they've encountered, and they say, you know, it destroyed their testimonies. I'm really grateful that people have arisen to sort of defend the church on the internet. I see, you know, people are not necessarily going to find those things. They're not necessarily going to be convinced by them. The problem that I see with encountering things on the internet and being thrown, you know, blown away by them has to do with the fragility of the beliefs that the people had ahead of time. And so my question, going back to something on the panel, it seems to me that church leadership is very aware of the existence of the internet in at least one regard, which has to do with pornography. But they must also be somewhat aware of the existence of anti-Mormon literature out there, and I'm curious whether anyone has a sense that a more robust version of the religion will be taught, that we'll be learning earlier about seven versions of the first vision or about other things like that that surprise people and make them feel they didn't know the truth and weren't taught it earlier. And whether, I mean, as you said, for you, you've seen these things and it's not a surprise, but for a lot of people, the religion is fragile or brittle or something like that. And
when Scott said that we don't discuss these things differently in church, we just don't talk about them, I think that's one thing that the rise of internet apologetics and debates might influence. I can imagine the church saying, look, we got to have theological discussions as well as ethical discussions in Sunday school. We need to provide a safe place. I was lucky enough to have that in my home. You know, when I started worrying about polygamy, my dad said, here are 10 books, let's talk about them. And not that, you know, that's ever going to happen that openly, but I suspect there may be a move towards more open discussion in a safe forum or some attempt to create that.
I'm very uncomfortable with the notion that the prophets are chapel Mormons as chapel Mormons has been defined. One simply needs to read from the Journal of Discourses to realize how much disagreement there was over very fundamental issues during the development of the theology during the 19th century. Something so basic, something so to the core as the very nature of God was debated publicly during conference by Brigham Young, between Brigham Young and Orson Pratt. Brigham Young would make a statement about the nature of God, Orson Pratt would disagree, and Brigham would send Orson on a mission. Orson Pratt was as much a prophet, seer, and revelator as Brigham Young, but he was not a president of the church. So to say that the prophets are chapel Mormons is to imply that they all have some sort of unanimity, unanimity on all assumptions. I would imagine that if I were to try and poll the general authorities today, those who bear the title prophet, to find out what their opinion of the Noachian flood was, I'd probably be told to stop wasting my time. This was not pertinent to my salvation, and go read the Book of Mormon. I don't really think that the prophets much care whether the deluge was a metaphorical baptism of the earth or a literal baptism of the earth. These are very intelligent men who understand the ramifications of believing that it's a literal baptism of the earth, and yet they don't walk down those paths and begin asking questions. Well, okay, if the earth needs to be baptized, then why aren't we baptizing animals? Because certainly animals possess spirits, as does the earth, and so on. And I think that the metaphorical nature of many of our Old Testament stories is understood by leaders in the church, and it's not anything more than that. And if somebody really pinned them down and said, "What do you really think was the earth?" I really do believe that there would not be unanimity among these men, and probably most of them would say, "This is foolishness. Let's, can we think of something else to debate on?"